only was I working at Willow and I worked at CityWell before that, but I was also leading retreats like on national platforms and stuff like that. So I was exposed to so much of the Christian world. And what Duke did was it gave me now the language that I was feeling in my body, in my soul. So I learned about not just tokenism, but what is coercive mimeticism? Like as a woman of color, like that I'm being forced to perform my race, like on a white stage. You're the Asian one. You are the Asian American face. You are our diversity. You represent all of Asia. I learned what all of those terms were. I learned to go deeper into an idea of multiple cosmologies and theologies.
Hi, everyone. This is Dana Black.
And this is Chelsea Simon.
Welcome to the Collective Table.
It's Chelsea here. Welcome back to season two called What God Looks Like. In this episode, Dana and I sit down with Angie Hong, a Korean-American, board-certified music therapist, pianist, vocalist, songwriter, worship leader, writer, and speaker. A lot of Angie's work revolves around diversity and identity in the church, specifically in reconciliation in worship. All of this plus balancing being a full-time mom of two boys. Angie is a very recent graduate of Duke Divinity School and is open to where the Spirit might be leading her next. In this conversation, Angie shares her experience as an Asian American female leader in the church, both the joys and the challenges of this work. It was a thought-provoking, insightful, and inspiring conversation. We hope you enjoy.
I'm so curious because as a woman in this space, I feel that what you're talking about, and then another layer. So how do you navigate that? Like when somebody says something to you that is insensitive or intentional, you know, like what? How do you navigate that?
Yeah, my last job was a very large white evangelical church. And I had a cohort of people of color that just, we would just be constantly texting like, oh my gosh, look what happened to me today. Like this is what happened. And we talked about negotiating what is the hill that we're going to die on, right? Like what kinds of battles are we going to choose? How are we going to decide who to have a conversation with, who is open to that conversation? And what do we know about the power dynamics and how do we negotiate that so we know that this person will listen to us and has power to change things, and this person will listen to us but may not be able to change things, and then this person has like absolute power and it could really reflect negatively on me. I think that's true for a lot of women, right? But then there's the whole women of color piece. So a lot of it is like, oh, you're being angry Asian. Why aren't you being compliant? Or I thought you wouldn't say anything because you're Asian. And so there are moments where I have to really like inject myself, make myself be heard in a very clear way. And they have to take me seriously versus other times where I'm just sort of observing in the background and sort of working in the background. And I think that's just a mixture of knowing yourself really, really well, knowing the politics of the place really, really well. And then a lot of like very spiritual wisdom. Like, honestly, I've had so many situations where I've just been like, okay, I need to take a step back and pray about it for 24 hours. I must do this and just be in deep contemplation about how to act. That in combination with just the experiences of the past that have shaped me, you know.
It's interesting because I was reading about your background and you started out kind of in, you were a board certified music therapist working. I mean, it sounds like you were working in worship communities, but then you had this unexpected call. So how does this evolve for you over time to where you are right now?
Making the switch from music therapy to worship leading, it was an easier transition because it's the same skill set. You're meeting people where they are, you're having compassion, unconditional acceptance, and then you're leading them to another place, a transformative place. And the added value of being a worship leader is that there's a spiritual dimension on top of physical, emotional, mental, cognitive, all these other things that we assess and things like that as a music therapist. So I just sort of saw it as like a very easy sort of natural transition. And the transition came about when I got this opportunity that I should have never gotten to lead worship for the Summer Institute for Reconciliation at the Duke Center for Reconciliation. And I must have been the last person that was on their list because at the time I was at home with a newborn. Can we like pause it for just a second? I just want to like tell them.
No. We all have kids.
Yeah, right. How old are yours?
I actually have three. My oldest is 21. Then I have almost 15-year-old and a 13-year-old.
You do not look like you have a 21-year-old.
No.
Oh,
thank you.
Oh my gosh.
Amazing. And I have a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old. So yeah. So we also, one of the things I want to talk to you about is how do you balance all of the things?
During pandemic, I'm in divinity school. Pandemic hit. I broke my ankle like the first month of the pandemic.
Oh my gosh.
So I had to have surgery and then the kids are at school. My kids are 7 and 10. So they're a little bit more independent, not as independent as yours, Dana, but more independent than yours, Chelsea. Yeah. And so, my expectations for myself in all areas went way down. I mean, I had very low goals, you know, like in the last days, it was like C's get degrees.
Yeah.
And I pretty much neglected my children for 2 weeks. But I feel like this, like, first of all, the community really stepped up because after the Atlanta massacre, I got tapped to do this Atlantic article. My immediate community, who gave me the communal blessing to write the piece because I was really conflicted about it. They, you know, they sent us food. They ordered us pizza. They took care of the kids. I mean, it was really, really amazing. So that was how I got to write the article. But then the article made me behind it on my classes for like, you know, 3 weeks. I was behind 3 weeks. And so I don't know, it was like an amount of like advocating for yourself and then just saying like, I'm going to let it go.
I know my motto for like daily life is like, someday you'll miss this. And I just like try to keep that at the forefront. Like someday I'll miss that my house is full or that people are screaming like they are now. And so it's like, someday you'll miss it.
This past weekend, we actually, our oldest son graduated from college on Friday. And he decided to go to Texas for college. We were originally all born and we're from the Northeast. We moved to Southern California 25 years ago. He decides he's going to Texas for college. We're like, okay.
My youngest was learning about the Trail of Tears and westward expansion. And he like busted my office because he had just learned about it. He's like, did you know this happened? Did you know this happened? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, why do people do this? Like, why do people do this? And I could just see the colonial wound like settle in him. And it kind of overtook him, his body is a little overwhelming. So I just, you know, I just held him for a long time. And I was like, yeah, like feel it in your body. He was breathing. We were breathing together. And, you know, I was explaining things like, yeah, a lot of people would call it like the Trail of Terror because that's what it was. That's what it was like. And this is our history. And so moments like that, I'm like, yes, I am glad to be there in these moments. And then other moments I'm like, when are you going to come back? Like, please come back.
It's interesting to hold that tension of those moments where, there's beautiful moments like that. And then there's beautiful moments of chaos and you're as a parent holding that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Did you grow up in a religious household?
Well, this is a very common immigrant story is that when people move to the United States, they try to find their people and they try to have community. And that most often is the church. So the church functions as a community center. You know, you can find a job there. You can learn English. You sing. They have their own hierarchies. Like they have presidents and like the deacons and the elders. Like that's all establishing a sort of sense of a city and a control over things that they have no control of or cannot participate in the larger U.S. So I grew up in a church. it was religious. I wouldn't say it was actually like all the way tuned into like a Christian sort of spirituality, but it was religious. It was a religious setting. Yes.
And then how did you find that? How did you find faith and religion and theology for yourself? How did that kind of come about?
I grew up Korean United Methodist, KUMC. And so the adults have service in Korean, and then the kids have a separate English language ministry. And this is a very common immigrant sort of church setting. And for a while, it was just sort of a glorified babysitting situation with us. So they would just drop us off, you know, for our English service. We would just have fun and hang out with our friends and like survive and try to figure out how to be Korean and American. And then there were some older teenagers from Florida, the Southeast area, which is where I grew up. I grew up in Atlanta. They decided to have a Southeast regional retreat just for Korean Americans, just for the second generation Korean American youth, because they saw problems. They saw that we were depressed. They saw that we were, you know, we were suicidal, and you know, we were getting caught up in a lot of gang activity, and none of us knew who we were, and you know, we hadn't really been exposed to the gospel because we were just sort of considered just children, you know. So they had that vision, and it was through one of those retreats that I got to know Jesus. So it wasn't until like 13 years old where I got to like really understand like who I was, and I've already been baptized as an infant, but that was when it became really, really real, and it was just over like even testimony of somebody just saying like, this is how I feel at school. And I just identified with their story so much that I was like, yeah, I want what you want. Like, I want what you have. And that sort of set me down the path.
Did you stay in that same church community in the Korean United Methodist Church, or did it transition to a different church or denomination?
In college, that's when it started to all change. And I think this is true for a lot of churches. They sort of kind of can't help but get influenced by whichever large mega church is in town. So for us, that was Passion. That was North Point, Andy Stanley, Louis Giglio. That was when all that was just exploding. And so we would go to Tuesday night Bible study at North Point, which was Andy Stanley's church, which was run by Louis Giglio. It was 2,000 people of a Bible study. And then that grew into his own church later on. But I think that's when we sort of, you know, we were looking for different resources that could fill a need that the Korean church could not provide at that point. And then in college, it was just a constant, you know, I'm a music major, I need money, I'll play at this church and I'll play this gig. I mean, it's the best gig is a church gig for a musician because it's so steady. So I did that. And that's when I got exposed to a lot. You know, I played for PCA church and then PCUSA, Baptist, you know, Southern Baptist. And so then I got exposed to all of that, that whole world.
And had to make sense of all those different pieces of.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I've worked at like close to 15 churches by now, just like in different capacities. And so you just sort of get all, you know, you get a lot of exposure.
Do you sing instruments both? Do you have a focus or a specialty?
I sing and I play keys. I was a piano major. So I sing and I play piano. As a music therapist, I did guitar a lot because you have to be very portable. And then the whole switching to worship leader, right? It's more than just the musical talent. It's the leading. And that's when I got really obsessed with like liturgy, because as a music therapist, you're always thinking about that too. Like, how am I going to walk into a room with my clients, and whether they're in palliative care or hospice or youth or even a NICU setting with infants, like how you walk into that really, really matters, and how you facilitate really matters. So that's when I got really obsessed with liturgy, and I'm still obsessed with it. But I got to really do that work through the Center for Reconciliation. And then later on at Willow Creek is when I became creative director. And that is just a fancy evangelical term for liturgist.
Well, I did not know that. Fancy.
Oh, yeah. That's a fancy name for a liturgist with dollars and production. Heavy emphasis on production and dollars. Yeah.
How long were you at Willow for?
2 years.
2 years. What was that like?
I had never really wanted to work at a evangelical megachurch before. It just wasn't in my interest. But we moved to Chicago for my husband's job, and I was interviewing at all these really wonderful churches out in Chicago. There's so many. And I got a call from Willow Creek, from one of the pastors there at the Chicago satellite location. And he was like, hey, do you want to be creative director? And I wanted to say no, but I really felt like God was saying, I want you to go here because I want you to see something. I remember that so clearly. And that I did, because towards the end of my time there was when all the Bill Hybels stuff came out. So that was when I really got to see things on that level. But working there is really interesting because excellence is key, communication is key, and business skills are so important at a church. Like, well, even more than a theology degree. So you're more likely to find a pastor who has a business degree than you will a seminary degree.
Because it becomes running a business.
Because you're running a corporation. Yes. And it's a corporation. I mean, they do, you know, they did great staff development. They can fly in anybody to lead our all staff meetings, which were, you know, close to like 300 people. And they know how to do that stuff. It's a well-oiled machine.
It's so interesting because like UMC, it's almost like we need a little spice. Like we need some staff development, but like the balance of like all of those skills, like you almost need all, you need all of it. And we just, I don't know what the combination of those things looks like. How do you balance those? Yeah.
I would definitely agree with Chelsea. We need a little bit of business. And I think I read that you went early to Duke. Is that right?
Yeah, I had already gotten accepted to Duke. So that story is really interesting too, how all that played out. But I had set my end date for this specific time. I think it was within 3 weeks. But then after the Bill thing came out, I pushed it up like almost 2 weeks. Yeah, I pushed it up because I needed to, that was over. That time was over.
Can you share the Duke story? Like, how did you get there?
Yeah, this has been a crazy journey. Thank y'all for really good questions. Halfway through my Willow time, I came back to Durham for a wedding. And I was talking to a former Duke Divinity School dean. His name is Richard Hayes. And he's a good friend of mine. I helped to plant a local UMC church here. And I was a music minister and he was in my worship band. And I threw everything out. I made him play like salsa music. I made him play gospel music and he did it. He never complained. And and so we were friends at that point. And so I was talking to him about my thing. I was like, Richard, I really feel like if I'm going to do a good job here, I have to drink the Kool-Aid and I just cannot do it. Like my body is just preventing me from going all the way there. And I said, I don't know what to do because I almost feel like I have to go to business school right now, honestly, or like film school or something. And he just looked dead in my eyes and he just said, Angie, forget about this business stuff. You should go to seminary. And I know, you know, it's not a perfect place, but I think you should come back and you should go to Duke. And he said that just very clearly. And I was like, Richard, of course you're going to say that. Like you're an academic and you were the dean of Duke. Like, of course you're going to say that. So I was like, whatever. He's like, just give it a shot, you know? So I applied and then I got in, I got a really good, you know, package deal. So that was sort of that. But I, more and more to the date, I was feeling like, yeah, this could be like really the next step. This is what I need. You know, this is what I need that I'm not getting at Willow, which is this high emphasis on excellence, production, business, but with a theology that wasn't like quite there. And then at a place like Citywell, the church that I helped to plant, it's like the theology was there, but like business skills, man, like organized, couldn't do that. And so I just felt like I had learned a lot of those missing skills at Willow. And so I wanted to put it all together and just go deep. And that's what Duke Divinity School was about, like what that time was about. And I learned so much.
It sounds like it was like the grounding, like there was like kind of this stuff floating, but there was like this real deep grounding of like what seminary could be, a space to kind of flesh all that out that you have experience from like the retreat to Willow Creek to what was the other church called? The church you planted?
It's called Citywell.
Citywell.
It's a multi-ethnic church plant. It's a new faith community. Y'all are in the UMC, right? I'm looking.
We're in the UMC.
So it's a new faith community. Is that right? Is that the term? So we were intentionally very multi-ethnic and all of that. Yeah. So I helped to plant it and then was the music minister there until I left for Chicago.
What are your thoughts moving forward? Where do you go? What do you do? What are you doing?
What am I not doing?
That's probably the better question. What are you not doing?
Yeah. This is what Duke afforded me. Duke afforded me the time to sort of step back and, you know, say like, wow, there's so much that happened in life. And not only was I working at Willow and I worked at Citywell before that, but I was also leading retreats like on national like platforms and stuff like that. So I was exposed to so much of the Christian world and the church world institutionally. And what Duke did was, it gave me now the language that I was feeling in my body, in my soul. So I learned about not just tokenism, but what is coercive mimeticism? Like as a woman of color, like that I'm being forced to perform my race, like on a white stage. You're the Asian one. You are the Asian American face. You are our diversity. You represent all of Asia. Not possible, by the way. Right. And so I learned what all of those terms were, you know, of course, like exegesis and theologies and all of that. But I learned to go deeper into an idea of multiple cosmologies and theologies, right? That I am exposed to this one way. And I was taught that that was the way. And actually, there are multiple theologies that count just as much, maybe even more, and that is a part of a larger picture. And so what is the story going on here? Like why has this been downplayed? How did these things develop? So yeah, like, you know, just sort of putting names to the things that I was feeling in my body and then learning about different theologies, it has been like monumental to like everything. And so moving forward, I want to incorporate that, but I am trying to find a place or a, not a container, but a space for that. And I figured out that that probably was not a traditional pastor role for now. But I kind of like in a very experimental mode and it's exciting. I'm doing some writing stuff. I'm doing the Collegeville Institute writing mentorship program. I'm doing some stuff with the leadership education at Duke and just other places, but it's going to look very like choppy for a little while.
Yeah. And that is the best place to be, is to have that ability to kind of, you know, swim through it and see where you end up. And it's exciting. It's exciting. And I remember when I started last year, and even now, and Chelsea hears me all the time, it's like, even coming, I was born and raised in the United Methodist Church, and but there's so much that I have now unearthed and learned. And I'm just like, okay, there's so much Christians in my space, I feel there's just so much for them to learn that we have yet to, like, there's so much we don't know. It's just, you're born into it. It's the water that you're, at least in my case. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, wait, what? You know, it's like the light bulbs start going off and it's like, okay, there's so much to share and grow into.
And see, that's so interesting you say it like that, right? Because to others, it feels like you are messing with their reality. Like you are telling them that their reality is not the only way. And it's like that can be really threatening to like a person's whole world and identity. And then like the fear sets in, anxiety, and then there's like backlash, right? And how have we gotten to the point where we're not open to things? Like, where was that cultivated that we had to be like, this is the defined way of being? I mean, that is something that I'm very curious about.
Yeah, I know this in black and white terms. And when you start to poke holes or ask questions, you feel like the whole thing's gonna fall apart. And I think for me, when I was going through that like deconstruction of faith, it was like, that was so interesting to me. Like, Mary was a virgin. Let's think about, like, or did, like, the purity culture thing, like sex before marriage. Like, let's have a conversation about that instead of like, okay, this is the black and white only way to think about it. And if you go outside the parameters, you're wrong. Sin, hell, all fire and brimstone and all that. And I like, and maybe people hit that at just different stages of their life. Like, they're ready to deconstruct or ask questions. And I'm always like with my kids, I'm like, how do I teach them things that they don't have to unlearn later? And I don't think that's possible, but like the most faithful way to do that.
I think that's why your podcast is so important. Like, when I was looking at it, I was like, yeah, this is exactly like y'all are fostering this like idea of just having a conversation, like, you know, making a place where people can really like wonder about these things and say like, I'm like making a switch, or I'm just realizing that there's something else there. I need sort of a guide or a place, a conversation to know that this is okay. And that this is actually being faithful, actually. Like, it's not being heretical. It's actually being super faithful.
Well, I think, you know, I think for me, you know, you were raised where, okay, you know, this is the way it is. Don't ask questions. And if you do ask questions, it's going to make your faith become something less than. And I've grown into realizing, no, it actually makes my faith stronger. Like, I become, you know, when I can seek with curiosity, my world expands, my perspective grows. And to Chelsea's point, I completely agree. It's how do we teach our kids to seek with that curiosity so that they can find for themselves the truth that works for them and not be like this fear that consumes us. I don't know where it comes from. I think it's a scarcity mentality. And people want to hoard. They want to keep what's theirs and not realize that, you know, there's something for everyone. We're all here together. We're better together, you know?
I think women, though, experience that fear more so. Like, you, in your article in The Atlantic, you talk about like the women really take owner, like they are forced to take ownership of purity and like, you know, we feel the shame and guilt. And then there's men just out there. And like, I'm not trying to shame men about, but like, then there's men out there doing all of these impure things. And it's, you know, we feel the fear of it where it just like kind of jumped over the male. And then I can't imagine on top of that being a woman of color and like all the other parameters of that also that you talk about. Mm-hmm.
It's really complex. And I'm really encouraged by people looking at those, you know, our Bible stories, our heroes, and explaining it from different perspectives, right? So like with like most common example, David and Bathsheba. So like, let's just say it's rape. I mean, just like say that. Why? You know, because that automatically shifts the whole perspective on the deal. You know, that she wasn't the one. She was doing her thing. She was fine. He went and he raped her. Let's just say that. And I think for women, like, right, we know it in our bodies. Like, we feel it in our bodies when things are not right because it hits us differently than men because we've been taught these things. And then for people of color, my biggest beef right now is with the whole concept of transcendence and like holiness. Like, we should just focus on Jesus and like transcendence, like we transcend because we are going to a better place. And so blah, blah, blah. All right. People of color cannot ignore their bodies because they're dying at the hands of other people. They're dying at hands of police or, you know, getting accused of things. I wish we could ignore our bodies. I wish we could be these transcendent spiritual beings that just love God and just, you know, we're floating around. But we don't have that privilege of ignoring our bodies. Like we feel the effects of other people ignoring their bodies on us, you know? And then for people of color, that's like a scary thing. Just like patriarchy can be really, really scary and a harmful thing to women inside the church. So I was almost waiting, Dana, for you to say, like, there's a scarcity mindset, there's like all this stuff, but I really do, and I don't know if this is okay to say this here, but I really do think that is a function of white supremacy.
You mean that white supremacy created this idea of scarcity mentality?
Well, scarcity is a function of white supremacy, but just that notion of like, this is the spiritual way. This is like the American way, and we're going to narrate it like this, and this is the reality. I mean, that in order to keep the hierarchy, in order to keep the men to do what they do, in order to keep the women down and the people of color, you know, at the opposite end of that, that is what keeps that system in place. So them defining it is very crucial for the continuation of white supremacy. And so like when you have like Black theology that comes like a totally different way, or you have a thriving Black church, because a Black church has not gone down in numbers like white churches have. They haven't gone down at all. They've remained stable. So that is threatening. that like threatens a lot of things, of systems that are in place, because the resources are going to have to go there, or the resources will be flowing from there. And so how do you deal with that after having all the power for so long? That's a threat. And you're teaching about liberation. The Bible is not hidden from them anymore like it was back in the good old days of America. You know, like they know the whole Bible, like we all know the whole Bible, and they see it from a totally different perspective from their bodily experience. And you can't ignore that. And that's very, very, that's such a threat.
When I do wonder about how, like, even Jesus' ministry, like when you read the actual gospels, how different that looks through different lenses, like for white evangelicals, it's like, where does Jesus talk about this transcend? I mean, you know, Jesus was feeding people and with people, and like their bodies and experience on earth mattered. And like, I think that like when you shift your lens a little bit, that becomes more evident. Like Jesus was with, like God came to us in a body because having a body and experience is important.
Yeah. Talk about Jesus having a body.
Right. Like, and it's just, like if it was a transcendence experience, like wouldn't God have stayed in heaven, like, or wherever God, you know, wouldn't God have stayed away? But God came as in a body. So I don't know.
Yeah. And not a king, and not like a, you know, not a higher up, like on the outskirts of town, and like all that, that's all political too. Right. So Jesus is political.
Yep.
Can't ignore it. It's like right there.
Right. But it does matter what you're saying. It's who has, or who claims this power over the narrative, and doesn't give voice for other theologies or other voices to chime in. Because if you lose control of the narrative, the power dynamics might shift on you, and you want to keep the status quo if you're a person of that feels like you're in power. And what's so confusing to me about that is, like, isn't the liberation of all of us and the connection of all of us the thing that, like, God's kingdom really is, right? Like that we're all liberated together.
Going back to this purity idea is, and sexuality is a huge topic for me, and one that I think we don't talk about enough in the Christian community. And when we do, it tends to center on this purity model, which I absolutely believe is a control mechanism by the patriarchy, and has, you know, it just is. And yet it is pervasive. Anyway, I just see it as one more thing. And I think that's why I was so moved by the article, because here I am raising a young woman, right? She's 13, and trying to teach her and my son as well. You know, I'm raising two boys to understand, you know, you are just as much a part of this process as the female is. You are just as much in this as the female, and you have to be a part of that. You can't just dismiss it or think that you're, you know, there are complicated lessons for young adults. And I think one of the areas that I struggle with, and I don't know, I'm kind of curious what your experience is I don't, like, besides the purity model, I don't feel like even in the United Methodist Church, we don't do a great job of talking to young people and young adults about sexuality, about consent, about healthy sexual relationships, what that looks like, exploring your body, loving your body.
Okay, we're going to go there now. I totally agree. And I was reading a book by Richard Rohr, the one that I think it's called Breathing Underwater. This was like years ago. And he said something like, we are just taught to disconnect from our bodies completely. Like it's like there's a soul in a body, and they're not like considered one or whole at all. And so no wonder we take things out on our bodies. No wonder we, in his case, you know, like alcohol and like substance abuse and stuff like that. But But when you think about it, like with the physical stuff too, with sexuality, I mean, there is so much there because we are not taught to connect with our bodies. And actually we were told the opposite, that it was bad. It was bad to do that, right? And so then we take things out of it, like we don't know how to connect to it. And that I think is also a function of white supremacy. Not to go like to sound like a broken record, but to go back to what you said about like just this purity culture and how it's just so pervasive. And I was thinking, yes, for people of color, there's an added thing of we will never be pure because we are not white. We cannot be pure as snow. If you think about the black body and how white supremacy functions to think of black body as criminal, as just bad and dirty and not even human. That's the legacy that is carried in the United States. And so people of color, especially black folk, it's like you can try to get there, but it's almost impossible to get there because you will never be white.
And I think as a white person, it's so necessary to be in these kind of conversations because I only know the world from my experience and my lens. And to hear that is really powerful because it's just, God, I never, like another privilege of whiteness that I never thought of before that I wouldn't have come on to my own. Like we need to be in, like reading from theologians and writers of different races and talking in conversations because I don't have access to that. Like, I don't know what that's like until that opens up for me.
Yeah. I mentioned in the article too, like Asian bodies, you know, whereas like black bodies may not be considered human and that's a whole other thing. But like with Asian bodies, there's this whole thing of exotification. Like you're exotic. Like I've been told that so many times, like you're so exotic and like your hair, or they'll talk about some aspect, like I'm just some sort of piece of, like I'm a doll, like I'm a China doll. I mean, that's kind of like how I feel. And so if you're going to hypersexualize me, if you're going to tell me I'm this flower, this exotic flower, like how can that be pure? Like how is that purified? That just gives grounds to do violence to exotify, to make that an object for your own play, whatever you want to do.
Totally agree. I wish everybody could see our heads nodding. Yes. Yeah. Like, how do we? So yeah, I go back to how, you know, I think the work we're all doing now is what starts to, and there's so many other people, like, because I go back to raising a daughter, like this is, and raising my sons, like, I think they're having a different experience than I had, and I'm grateful, but there's still so much more to do and be done and to continue growing and doing. So always trying to figure out what that looks like. Yeah.
When you figure that out, you let us all know.
I don't think I'm ever going to figure it out.
Well, we're so grateful. Thank you so much for the time and for your thoughtfulness. I'm really going to sit with a lot of the things that you said. There were new things for me to kind of reflect on. So I'm grateful for that.
Yes. Thank you very much. We appreciate your time, your effort, your energy, and the ministry that you're walking into, whatever it may be.
Thank you for having me. This was really a great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. Just like everyone we are interviewing throughout this series reflects the sacred and holy image of God, so do you. Together, we are what God looks like.
The Collective Table is supported by San Diego United Methodist Church in Encinitas, California.
A big thank you to the team at Castos, especially our producer, Stuart Barefoot, and our content editor, Claire Watson.
The original music heard in this episode was created and performed by Mystic Mercy.
Make sure to subscribe to the podcast, YouTube channel, and our newsletter.
If you'd like to financially support the work of The Collective Table, please visit thecollectivetable.org. There you can also find out more about who we are and view past episodes.